The screams echo around the home, long after the child has fallen silent. Even after she's gone, those who visit to document the last moments of her life will hear her. A stolen voice, but one that continued to speak beyond the grave. This is where it happened. This is what they did. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 189, The Murder of Siobhan Rush. Make upgrading your home security a priority with Ring's range of smart security devices, indoor and outdoor cameras, video doorbells, and alarms. Ring products are easy to install and allow you to monitor your home from your phone or tablet via the Ring app, no matter where you are. With cameras in strategic locations, indoors and outdoors, you can create a ring of security around your property. Ring security devices boast advanced features, including live view, two-way talk, motion-activated alerts, and night vision. Ring will be at Decorex, showcasing their wide range of advanced home security devices from the 24th to the 27th of July at Sandton Convention Centre. With Ring, you're always home. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Estelle Nordia, Chantal van der Berg, Brett Meyerwitz, and Robbie McCain for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. It's been quite some time since I've covered a child murder case on the podcast. These ones are as tough for me to research and speak about as they are for you to listen to. But as I often say, the stories that are the hardest to tell and hear are often the ones that need to be told the most. This has perhaps never been as true as right now, as we've been inundated with cases where children have been murdered or alleged to have been harmed by their own parents, their mothers especially. Little Jocelyn Smith, whose mother was recently found guilty of arranging her trafficking and remains missing. Kutlwano Shalaba, whose body has recently been found after his mother was arrested for initially also arranging trafficking, and is now charged with a child's murder too. And most recently, at least in the media, 11-year-old Jaden Lee Meek, who was found dead in the complex he lived in, and his mother has just been arrested for his murder. It's been alleged that Jaden was abused at home for many years and that he asked for help, but never received it. When I covered the case of Poppy Fantamava, who was also murdered by her mother and her mother's partner, I never expected that episode to become one of the most listened to in the podcast's history. It seems that as much as we don't want to hear these stories, something still draws us to them. Perhaps it is the horror of childhood innocence being so easily ripped away by those who are supposed to protect them. Or maybe it's the question of our own role in these crimes as people who might sometimes become aware of child abuse. Almost all of these cases have one thing in common. The abuse was reported, and nothing happened. And as I struggled through the descriptions of the terrible things that were done to the children in this case, I thought perhaps that was the point. The more we tell these terrible stories, the more we help inform people about what to look for, and most importantly, how to get help. I'll talk more about this in the episode itself. In researching this case, I used the sentencing document from the trial, an article in the Sevamus magazine, and several media sources. So, let's get into episode 189. The murder of Siobhan Rush.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Rochelle Buerta grew up in a loving family in Gauteng, South Africa. In her teens, she started dating Bradley Rush. Rochelle was just 16 years old when she fell pregnant for the first time in 2017. After the birth of their oldest daughter, Rochelle gave birth to two other children in the next 2 years. Both her family and Bradley's were concerned at the situation. The couple were incredibly young to have three children, and they were very clearly not coping. I must say at this point that the two older Rush children are not named to protect their identities. I will also say that although we know that Rochelle was using drugs later on, I cannot say for sure that she was doing so with Bradley, nor do I allege that Bradley Rush was or is a drug user. What we do know is that the couple's lives in those 3 or 4 years were tumultuous. They often did not have any income or any way to house or care for their children. As a result, the children often lived with various relatives, and as there were three of them, keeping them all together with one relative was difficult, so the children were often separated. I must acknowledge at this point as well that there are no reports or allegations on record of abuse against the children during this time. It would later emerge that the birth of Siobhan, the youngest daughter, had not been registered. This is, of course, illegal, but it's also not terribly uncommon in South Africa, because so many women do not have easy access to the facilities to do so. This happens especially when women don't give birth in hospital, as many hospitals do now have a small home affairs unit where births can be registered even before leaving the hospital. Not having registered a child's birth creates major issues later in their lives, but it's equally difficult from the start, as free clinic services, including vaccinations, need to be accessed using a birth certificate initially. After that, a clinic card is issued to the baby, which tracks their growth and vaccination status if the mother is using government facilities. Allegations would later be made, which were supported by screenshots of WhatsApp messages, that Rochelle had sold her older children's clinic cards to other mothers who had yet to register their child's births so that they could gain access to clinic care. While not registering a child's birth is certainly not always done with nefarious intentions, it is important to remember that if a child is not registered, they essentially also cannot be tracked by authorities in terms of whether that child starts to attend school when they come of age. A child whose birth is not registered can also very easily disappear without there ever having been a physical record of their existence. I have seen other cases where severe abuse has occurred in families and births were also not registered. One example that springs to mind is the infamous Springs House of Horrors, which I covered way back in episode 14. While it, of course, would not have been emotionally healthy for the children to be continuously moved around and separated from their parents and each other, by all accounts, the family members who assisted with care during this time did do an excellent job, and the children were happy and healthy. In 2021, when the youngest Rush child was just a year old, Bradley was arrested and convicted on a theft charge. He was sentenced to time in prison, and this seemed to be the nail in the coffin for Bradley and Rochelle's relationship. The children were at this time living with their great-grandparents, and according to everyone, doing very well. It was also around this time that Rochelle met Stefan Fanikak. The 35-year-old was 12 years older than Rochelle, and he had a rather dodgy background. He was also a methamphetamine user, a habit which it would become clear he and Rochelle began to share, if she had not already been a user by that point. The couple soon moved in together into a container home in the yard of a homeowner in Klopper Park, Gauteng. Rochelle would bring the children home to visit on weekends. Only very occasionally would all three be there at the same time, as Rochelle claimed the home was too small for them all. Rochelle's lifelong friend Kayla would later say that, in retrospect, it seemed like once Rochelle moved in with Stefan, she began to isolate herself from her friends and family, and they saw less and less of her. Everyone assumed that this must have been Stefan's doing, and while that may be true to an extent, it's also clear that Rochelle was using drugs quite heavily, and substance use disorders can have a similar distancing effect, where the user becomes solely focused on getting their next hit and loses all interest in everything else. Perhaps it was because of the shift in Rochelle's demeanor, or maybe because she'd only known Stefan for a year, that when she suddenly decided in April 2022 that she wanted all three of her children to come and live with her permanently, her and Bradley's families were taken aback and certain it was not a good idea. It's unclear how many people actually visited the children at the couple's home after they went to live with them. Much later, photographs of the scene would show a squalid living environment with no space for three children. The youngest child, Siobhan, who was by then 2 years old, didn't have her own bed. And now, many South African families live in deep poverty, and children sharing beds or homes being less than ideal due to financial circumstances is certainly not indicative of abuse. What is concerning, though, is when that home is filthy and clearly not set up for the safety of children. While I'm sure that the children had already begun to suffer abuse at the hands of Stefan and Rochelle when they were visiting on weekends, it's very clear that when they moved in full-time, the abuse and neglect escalated to shocking extremes. While the full extent of what the children endured will never really be known, the second oldest child, a boy who was 3, soon started to bear the physical signs of what was happening in the home in Klopper Park. Kayla, Rochelle's friend, was one of the first to see the worst of it. Soon after the children moved in with Rochelle and Stefan, they started to make it really difficult for Rochelle and Bradley's family to see the children, especially the great-grandparents, who'd been happily raising the children, only to have them suddenly snatched away, were distraught and tried endlessly to make arrangements to see them. It's clear now, although it wasn't at the time, that Rochelle and Stefan limited who could see the children, so that the bruises and other injuries were not seen. Kayla, though, was able to see the children a little while after they'd moved in with Rochelle and Stefan, and what she saw on the body of the young boy shocked her. The boy's bottom, lower back, and upper legs were a patchwork of deep blue, black, green, and purple bruises. And if that was not bad enough, Kayla noticed blood caked in the child's hair, and upon inspection, saw a deep cut in his scalp. After a lot of probing, the child finally admitted that Stefan had used an angle grinder to cut him as punishment for something he'd done. Kayla was horrified and made a decision in that moment that her long friendship with Rochelle could crash and burn if it meant that the children were going to suffer this type of abuse. While the bruising was bad enough, after hearing that Stefan had held an angle grinder to the boy's head, Kayla realized that the child's life was undoubtedly in danger, and she decided to report the abuse. Like most people, Kayla had no idea where to start, so she made contact with child welfare in Edenvale. They told her that the case was outside of their jurisdiction. She then contacted Childline in Gauteng, who, upon hearing that there was an imminent danger to the child, told her to contact 10111. The emergency number was not answered. Finally, a police officer made contact with Kayla and told her that they had been to the house, but because they didn't have cause to make entry, they just stood at the gate. He told Kayla that he now had the address and he would keep an eye out for any other disturbances there. This, of course, was not what Kayla wanted. She didn't want the next time a disturbance was recorded to be one of the children suffering more abuse, or worse. But she continued to be sent from pillar to post, without receiving any assistance over the next month. Despite no action being taken over the little boy's injuries, it seems that either Rochelle and Stefan realized they were being looked at over their abuse toward him, or perhaps the cycle of abuse simply moved on to become more severe toward the other children. Either way, it seems that little Siobhan soon became the main target of Stefan's rage and Rochelle's neglect. Although the children's grandparents and great-grandparents were begging to see them, whenever the couple needed time away, they increasingly chose to drop the children off with people related to Stefan. Although this could have been a control tactic from Stefan, it's far more likely that he was just more comfortable being able to talk his way out of any questions with his own family, who didn't really know the children, rather than Rochelle or Bradley's family. In early May 2022, Siobhan was dropped off at Stefan's brother's house. Despite it being freezing cold and the middle of winter, the child was dressed in nothing but shorts and a t-shirt. She was not fully potty trained yet, but also did not have a nappy on. So if she didn't make it to the toilet in time, she would wet her shorts. A visitor to the home where Siobhan was that day saw the child and was immediately concerned. Besides the inappropriate clothing for the weather, the child was also covered in bruises. The woman, named Chanel, later said that her facial injuries were the most disturbing, with almost half the child's face covered in dark bruises and her lip appearing to be swollen and either split or burned at first glance. Chanel had asked Stefan's family what had happened to the girl, and they said that she'd fallen at home. Siobhan had been dropped off with no supplies, no food, milk, extra clothing, nappies, or anything else. Stefan's brother didn't have any children, so they had nothing that Siobhan needed. And as Chanel looked at the child, she thought that she simply could not leave her behind. Chanel had her own toddler at home, and it was perhaps the horrendous difference between the two children, in both appearance and demeanor, that struck her the most. She needed time to figure out what she was going to do to help this child, she thought. So she asked Stefan's brother if she could take Siobhan home with her for the night. His brother said it was fine, but he thought they should probably check with Rochelle first. And fair enough. If a child is left in your care, you most certainly need to check with their caregiver before handing them over to someone else. But I think it was Rochelle's response to this that surprised me the most. Rochelle didn't know Chanel. She'd never met her. Had no idea who she was or where she lived, what her home was like, or what type of parent she was. And yet, she quite happily agreed that her child could be handed over to a complete stranger. Sure, Stefan's brother knew this person, but this was her child. She'd only known Stefan's family for a year. I guess this shouldn't surprise me, considering what would come to pass. But it's still a pretty good indicator, I think, of just how unsafe these children were. Thankfully for Siobhan, Chanel was a safe person, and when she took her home that night, she carefully bathed her, dressed her in her own child's clothing, fed her, and swaddled her up for sleep. Siobhan screamed throughout most of this, especially the bath. Chanel said it was a noise she'd never heard come out of a child before. Eventually, though, as she rocked Siobhan and soothed her in her arms, the child began to quiet down. While Chanel had been caring for Siobhan that night, she'd been documenting her injuries by photograph. As the tiny child succumbed to sleep, she knew that although this child would go back to her family the next day, for her, this would just be the beginning, because she was not going to let this go. The next morning, Chanel contacted Childline. She sent an email with photographs of Siobhan's injuries and explained that there were other children in the home too. The only reply she received was an automated email telling her to report the matter to the SAPS. Now, before I go on, I want to make clear that the organisation Childline has been mentioned twice now, and I'll discuss a bit later on how confusion about the roles that various organisations play can be problematic and even deadly. I think it's important that we don't place responsibility at the door of organisations like Childline, who do incredible work in the specific role they fit into in the landscape of child abuse. Even though Chanel did not get the response she'd expected, she planned on continuing to try and get help for Siobhan and her siblings. Unbeknownst to her, Kayla was also still working to try and get intervention into the situation. As Chanel had held Siobhan that night, she could have no idea that it was the last time in the child's life that she would feel comfort, a full stomach, an absence of fear, and the loving touch of an adult. in just 4 days from that moment. The worst outcome that anyone could ever have expected came to pass. I will warn you that the next few minutes of the podcast contain graphic descriptions of injuries to a child. On the 11th of May 2022, Stefan van Niekerk ran into the Vonnenberg Clinic in Primrose, Germiston. He was accompanied by two other men. In his arms was a small bundle wrapped in a blanket. As he handed the bundle over, he explained that the child had drowned. Clinic staff pulled the blanket away to find the body of two-year-old Siobhan Avril Rush inside. Siobhan was declared dead soon after her arrival at the clinic, and nurses and doctors immediately knew that this was no drowning case. As police were called, a doctor began to assess the condition of Siobhan's body. What they found was a tiny body covered in more bruises and injuries than they could count. The forensic pathologist would later put the estimate at least 49. The child's mouth was caked in blood, and she'd sustained a serious injury to the back of her head. The staff would have liked to have asked Stefan van Niekerk questions about how these injuries had been sustained during this alleged drowning, but they couldn't, because not long after Siobhan had been declared dead, which happened relatively quickly after their arrival, Stefan and his friends left the clinic. I remember the early days after Siobhan's murder and the reaction on social media. Of course, there was horror and sadness and anger. Allegations surfaced thick and fast, and most of them would later be proven false. But what was clear and true from the start is that this two-year-old child, who in photos from her time with her great-grandparents smiled broadly, her skin clear and as perfectly unblemished as any toddler's should be, her eyes shining with sweetness and a little mischief, had been badly failed. The question was, who had failed her and how? And for quite some time, it seemed like she would continue to be failed. Thanks to the actions of the medical staff at the clinic, it was immediately clear that this was not just a case of unnatural death to be investigated, but most definitely one of murder. And Stefan van Niekerk would be arrested a few days after Siobhan's death, but not on a charge of murder, at least not initially. It turned out that Stefan had a warrant of arrest out for him on another case, the details of which have never been disclosed. I thought perhaps police had used this warrant to secure his arrest while they properly investigated the murder charges, but that doesn't really seem to be what happened. Rochelle Buerta was not arrested. Rather, she and her remaining children were at first ensconced by family, as everyone tried to figure out what had happened. The night after Siobhan's death, Rochelle sent the following voice note to a friend explaining what she remembered from that night.
You also could say, "Mommy, help me. Mommy, please." But I'm gonna quack, quack, quack. As I'm gonna scream, Stefan, help me. I was ignored.
The voice note is in Afrikaans. So for those who do not understand the language, or perhaps if the audio is unclear, Rochelle says, she said, "Mommy, help me. Mommy, please." Then I heard, "Gwa, gwa, gwa." And then I screamed, "Stefan, stop it." So essentially at this point, Rochelle was claiming that Stefan had attacked Siobhan and she had heard it but had been unable to stop it for some reason. That's not what she would say to everyone else. Early on, Rochelle was still insisting that Stefan would never do anything to harm her children, and Siobhan's death had been a tragic accident. As the news trickled out to family and friends, Bradley Rush, who had been released from his own prison term a month before, discovered that his daughter was dead. The two women who had tried so hard to get help for the children also discovered that their attempts had been futile. And Kayla, particularly, was caught in a position where she wanted to support her friend, but felt incredibly conflicted in doing so. There was a large amount of public outrage in the early stages after Siobhan's murder, and it was very clear that most people were blaming Rochelle as much as they were blaming Stefan. On the 25th of May 2022, Stefan appeared in court for the first time, and a crowd of protesters outside heckled Rochelle as she arrived for the court session. Eventually, she left without attending because she felt her life was in danger. Such was the anger reverberating off the onlookers. Bradley Rush told the media that day that he and his family had been trying to get full custody of the children, but they'd been sent from pillar to post. Stefan Vanikak abandoned his bid for bail early on, and the prosecution requested extra time for further investigations. The extent of those further investigations would later be questioned by many people. One person in particular who had an issue with this was Annerie Duplessis, a former policewoman who founded the Go Purple Foundation. Annerie became involved in the Siobhan Rush case early on, and by virtue of her contacts within the SAPS, bore witness to the poor level of investigation that took place, which she believes may have allowed other perpetrators in this case to go free. You may or may not be surprised to learn that the house in which Siobhan was killed was never forensically searched by the SAPS. Annerie knows this because she accompanied officers on their first visit there 8 days after Siobhan had died. She saw what she knew could be vital evidence. Blood spatters, a pillow with blood on it, and other evidence, especially in the bathroom where Stefan claimed Siobhan had died. When she asked the senior officer on scene when forensics would be arriving to document the evidence, he told her they wouldn't. According to him, the scene was already contaminated, and it was pointless. In fact, the SAPS did not even think taking photographs was important, but Annerie did, and she took pictures on her phone, which would later be shown in court to document the filth and squalor the children were forced to live in, as well as what she believed was important biological evidence. Annerie firmly believed, and still does, that Stefan's two friends may have had something to do with Siobhan's murder. The men were never named, and their only role in the trial would be to testify as witnesses. At minimum, Annerie thought that Rochelle Buerta surely needed to share criminal responsibility for what was clearly long and drawn-out abuse of the children. Annerie would go far beyond the scope of what would be thought necessary to make this happen. When she noted that a young, relatively inexperienced officer had been assigned to investigate the case, and also that this officer did not speak Afrikaans, which was the language in which most of the communication that formed the documentary evidence in this case was written, and the language that most of the witnesses spoke, she grabbed her printer and, with permission, moved into the office where the detective was based, offering her services and time to assist in any way she could. There was a lot of evidence in text and voice note form from Rochelle and Stefan to other people and each other that could help to prove that not only had Rochelle been aware of the abuse, that she'd actively tried to thwart attempts to get the children help. Siobhan's body lay in the mortuary for months. Although the autopsy had been completed, there was a legal complication in that Siobhan's birth had never been registered. The little blonde girl, who only ever got to live 2 years of her life, ended up having her birth registered only shortly before her death was. Then, finally, she could be laid to rest. Rochelle Buerta was still walking free on the day of her daughter's funeral. It was understandably a somber event, but those who'd loved the child tried to make it a little more like Siobhan's personality by adding small childlike touches. As her tiny coffin was carried into the church, her favourite song, Dance Monkey, played softly in the background. Her loved ones would likely have been picturing how the two-year-old in happier times had bobbed back and forth to the song every time it played. That image was now set in sharp contrast to the knowledge that she died so brutally and been forced to live equally so for at least 40 days before her death. The pastor told those gathered, "A child is a gift from God. The Lord gave us this special person to look after, not to abuse. She was supposed to be loved and cherished. Parents must never trust anyone with their children. They were given to you, and you must care for them." Rochelle Buerta could seemingly not take the heavy atmosphere and quickly broke away from the crowd, ending up sitting on the stairs of the church while friends attempted to support her. Finally, in August 2022, Rochelle Buerta was arrested. As the results of Siobhan's autopsy, examinations of and interviews with her two siblings, and other evidence came to light, additional charges were added, which only spoke to an even greater horror than what the public had thought already existed. At Rochelle's first hearing, it was announced that she would face multiple charges, including several counts of child abuse, one count of attempted murder, one count of murder, and the aiding and abetting of the acts of rape and sexual assault. The cumulative charges were for crimes committed against all three of the Rush children. Rape and sexual assault charges were also added to Stefan's charge sheet, which already listed several counts of child abuse, attempted murder, and murder. Because the victims of the sex crimes in particular are minors, the details of the events and which victims suffered what type of sexual abuse are not easily publicly available. It would emerge, though, that the older girl, who had been just 4, had been raped by Stefan at least once, and Siobhan had also experienced sexual assault from Stefan. Horrifically, the court would also hear that Rochelle had allowed various unnamed men to touch Siobhan's genitals in exchange for money or drugs. Rochelle did not apply for bail, and she remained incarcerated as several postponements ensued in the case, leading 2022 into 2023, when the case was transferred to the High Court for pretrial hearings in February of that year. When the trial began on the 31st of July 2023, both Rochelle and Stefan pled not guilty to the charges against them. Their plea statements made their stances clear. Stefan was still claiming that Siobhan's death was an accident and he had not abused or raped the children, and Rochelle was claiming that she was a victim of abuse herself and claimed that on the day of Siobhan's murder, Stefan had tied her to a white plastic chair and she'd been unable to assist her child. As for the abuse charges, she claimed that she had no idea Stefan was abusing her children. Thanks to witness testimony and the photographs taken by Anne-Marie Duplessis, the prosecution was quickly able to punch holes in Rochelle's story. None of the photographs showed any white plastic chairs anywhere on the property. You'll also remember that voice note, where Rochelle says nothing to a friend the very next day about having been tied up. It emerged that Rochelle had refused to look at Siobhan's body after she died. She refused to identify her in the mortuary and even in court refused to look at any photographs of her child's injuries. When the pathologist took the stand to testify that Siobhan had died from severe head trauma and that her body had been riddled with many other injuries in various stages of healing, Rochelle sat crying and shaking her head. She would later take the stand in her own defense, an unusual move, but one that certainly did not work in her favor. The young woman stood absolutely no chance in keeping up her various versions against the highly experienced prosecutor Rihanna Williams, and Rochelle was soon admitting that she had been aware of certain instances of abuse, which she often categorized as Stefan being too forceful with discipline. She claimed that she had tried to stop him on several occasions, but he would just turn the abuse on her. In a shocking moment, a witness testified that the burn on Siobhan's mouth had been caused by Stefan's meth pipe, and that he had also forced one of the other children to inhale meth. As for the rape and sexual assault charges, both Rochelle and Stefan vehemently denied these. But a female friend of Rochelle's testified that Rochelle had told her she didn't let Stefan bath the girls anymore because of something that had happened with the older child. That something was a rape. Although the older child was just 4 at the time, she would provide a clear description of the crime that was committed against her. Police were also able to find evidence on Rochelle's phone, which they confirmed with witness testimony, related to the mother having received money and drugs in exchange for allowing men to sexually assault Siobhan. Stefan, too, took the stand in his own defense. He admitted that he'd been very high on drugs on the day of Siobhan's death and said he didn't remember a lot of what had happened. But he said he remembered running a bath for her and putting her in it. He claimed he left the bathroom, and when he returned, Siobhan was floating in the water. He believed she must have slipped and hit her head. The pathologist's testimony, of course, indicated that the injuries to Siobhan's head were not as a result of a single blow where she may have fallen and hit her head on the side of the bath and lost consciousness. There were also no signs of drowning in the child, meaning that if there had ever been any water in the bathtub, she had not been breathing when she was placed into it. Of course, the pathologist would have been unable to say exactly what blunt object had caused the injuries to Siobhan's head. But if we take all we've heard, and also consider that there is always a thread of truth to every lie, it's very likely that Siobhan did die in that bathroom. And the gua, gua, gua sound that Rochelle claimed to have heard was Stefan either striking her head with something or hitting her head against something in the bathroom. This riddle may have been solved if immediate action had been taken after Siobhan was declared dead at the clinic and the police had brought in a forensics team. But of course, that had not happened. Stefan denied ever giving the children drugs and claimed that they'd always tried to smoke drugs away from the children. He could not explain why several witnesses would have given different testimony. In cross-examination, Rochelle would eventually admit that she had inflicted some of the injuries to Siobhan and the other children herself. She admitted one specific incident where she'd smacked Siobhan so hard in the mouth that the child had bled from a split lip. She also admitted that at no time during the 40 days her children were with her, at the end, did she ever seek medical attention for them, despite the children having serious injuries, such as the cut from an angle grinder on her son's head, which should have been stitched up and could easily have become infected. A lot of evidence presented in the trial against Rochelle came from her own WhatsApp communications. This included several pleas from her grandparents to send photographs of the children as they missed them terribly after they'd been abruptly removed from their care. The text threads clearly showed Rochelle either completely ignoring these requests or dodging them by saying the children were elsewhere and she'd send photographs later. Of course, Rochelle knew very well she could not send photographs of the children because their faces were bruised and Siobhan's mouth was badly injured. It would later be revealed that due to the injuries to her mouth, Siobhan had been unable to eat anything other than soft porridge for at least 10 days prior to her death. Throughout her cross-examination, Rochelle continued to insist that she was not aware of the extent of Stefan's abuse of the children and that she did not know he posed a threat to their lives. On the 17th of November 2023, Judge Annalene Africa handed down her judgment to the two accused. In a four-hour judgment, she adjudicated the evidence that had been presented to the court, and it became clear that she was utterly convinced of the guilt of both parties. She was particularly scathing toward Rochelle, saying that she'd been more interested in doing her nails and smoking cigarettes in the sun than saving her child from the hands of the monster she'd brought into their lives. She further lambasted the woman for attempting to claim that she'd had no choice but to stay with Stefan, saying that she'd inexplicably ripped her children away from her grandparents who'd been happily caring for them, and there'd been no need for her to subject her children to that abuse. She found both Rochelle Buerta and Stefan van Niekerk guilty of all the charges against them. As the judgment was handed down, Rochelle shouted out perhaps the only truthful word she'd spoken since her arrest. She screamed at Stefan, saying she hated him, and saying, "Look what has happened now. Look what has happened now. You mean your daughter being dead and your other children having immense trauma to live with, right? Oh, no. You mean, look how you are now being held accountable for your actions. That's what has happened now." That point that the judge raised about the children inexplicably being taken away from their great-grandparents has been something that's bugged me throughout this. Siobhan died just 40 days after all three permanently moved back in with their mother and Stefan. Yes, there had been weekend visits before, but no one could quite fathom why the sudden shift had happened. The only thing that I can think, and I will say that this is total speculation, is that with Bradley out of prison, both Stefan and Rochelle knew that he would likely try to get custody. And that would mean that they would miss out on any financial benefits they would get from the children being with them in terms of maintenance. In addition, perhaps with Rochelle being unemployed, she may have also been claiming a social grant for the children, at least the first two, because Siobhan's birth wasn't registered. And perhaps with the children staying at her grandparents, that money was understandably going to them to help raise the children. And maybe that was an additional financial incentive for the couple to want the children with them instead. It's either that, or Stefan very simply wanted the children available there to abuse. Sentencing procedures in the case would come next, and the court would hear a little more about Stefan van Niekerk's own childhood. He, like Rochelle, had grown up in a loving and secure home, although his mother had sadly passed away when he was relatively young. His father had taken over as a widowed single parent and continued to raise his children. Stefan, though, would tell a social worker that although his father had provided for him, he'd never been as emotionally present as he needed him to be, and he thought that was where a lot of his problems had come from. One major point of neglect Stefan outlined from his father was that he'd never attended his rugby games. And I don't mean to make light of that, because if Stefan was sitting in a therapist's office trying to work through his childhood trauma, this would certainly be a very valid point to be bothered by. But to even utter such a ridiculous thing in mitigation of raping a four-year-old, sexually assaulting and murdering a two-year-old, is just beyond me in terms of ludicrousness. His lawyer underpinned that Stefan was very remorseful for what had happened and asked the judge to take into account that he'd been using drugs very heavily when all of the crimes had taken place. Stefan claimed to be committed to rehabilitation and asked that if the judge would hand down a sentence which could give him hope at release, he would work hard at any programs available to him in prison. Rochelle's defense team continued to insist that she had been the victim of abuse from Stefan, and that she was actually a loving and caring mother who'd been caught up in a terrible situation and her drug use had just made things worse. In aggravation, the prosecution brought in an expert in child abuse. Luke Lamprecht from Women and Men Against Child Abuse has extensive experience in several different forms of child abuse. I actually had the pleasure of meeting Luke when I worked with him on the School Ties television series, which documented the abuse that had taken place at several private boys' schools throughout South Africa. Luke had been asked to review the case against Rochelle and Stefan and present his expert opinion on the nature of the case in the context of the hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of other child abuse cases he had worked on. In a moment that really put things into perspective, he explained that the level of torture, neglect and abuse the three Rush children suffered would be considered war crimes if they had been adult prisoners of war. Lamprecht told the courts that Stefan and Rochelle had actively hidden the abuse of the children from others in ways he has seen countless times in other cases. It was clear that they knew what they were doing was wrong, and yet they refused to stop. Lamprecht said that Siobhan's life could undoubtedly have been saved, and not just by others, but primarily by Rochelle and Stefan themselves, if they just chosen to leave the children in the custody of the people who were far better placed to care for them. Lamprecht said that in his assessment, Rochelle shared just as much guilt as Stefan, because she had actively, time and time again, chosen her lover and her drug habit over the well-being of her children. He pointed out that Stefan's behavior after Siobhan's death, of trying to put the blame on others, and even Siobhan herself, was classic abuser behavior. Lamprecht also emphasized something which seems quite important. In his interviews with social workers and also in witness testimony, it emerged that Stefan had felt jealous of the children, and he didn't like that when they were around, Rochelle's attention was divided. He also seemed to use the children as pawns to hurt and control Rochelle. It also seemed clear, Lamprecht said, that Stefan actually did not view the children as human beings, but rather objects, which he could use for his own pleasure, and as a way to release his aggression without lashing out at Rochelle, who could fight back. Lamprecht explained that even the surviving children would never be the same again, saying that research has shown that trauma disrupts the development of a child's brain, and it takes a lot of work to try and correct that disruption, and full recovery to their original potential may never be possible. He also pointed out that the surviving children would not just be impacted by the abuse they had personally suffered, but also by the violence they had witnessed. For the older child who had been raped, Lamprecht said, when a child is sexually abused by someone in a caregiver role, the psychological damage is already enormous. But when another caregiver, in this case their mother, is aware of that abuse and does nothing to prevent it or help the child seek justice, the damage is amplified many times over. Lamprecht said that in his expert's opinion, neither of the perpetrators in this case of child abuse seemed to have any good prospects at rehabilitation. And if they were put in the same situation in the future, they would undoubtedly behave the same way. He also emphasized that it was vital for the surviving children to know that justice had been done for them and for their sister, and that their abusers were being punished. While Stefan's defense lawyer acknowledged the need for a prison sentence, Rochelle's asked that she be allowed to serve a community-based sentence instead. The state, on the other hand, wanted life sentences for both parties. When Judge Africa handed down her sentencing in April 2024, she did not hold back, saying, quote, "The evidence shows that it was never the intention of accused one, Rochelle, to expose accused two, Stefan. She used every conceivable opportunity to concoct stories, to lie, and mask the behavior of accused two, even describing him as a caring and loving father who does not even raise his voice to the children." What a devastating lie these words turned out to be. Mr. Lamprecht described accused one as a mother who chose her sexual partner over her children and chose one thing over everything else: drugs. This court could not agree more. End quote. Rochelle Buerta was sentenced to 25 years incarceration for murder, 25 years for aiding and abetting rape, 10 years for attempted murder, as well as additional sentences for the child abuse and aiding sexual assault. All of her sentences would run concurrently, meaning she will serve an effective 25 years behind bars. Stefan Fanikak received two life sentences for murder and rape, along with multiple additional sentences for child abuse, sexual assault, and attempted murder. Rochelle burst into tears upon hearing her sentence, and her lawyer immediately requested an appeal of her sentence. Luke Lamprecht told journalists that he hoped on appeal her sentence would be increased to life rather than reduced. It was a sentiment shared by many present that day, as the sentence seemed to reflect an ongoing refusal by the courts to hand down a deserving sentence to a woman complicit in the abuse, neglect, and ultimate murder of her child. The next months, that hope would be dashed, but so would Rochelle's, as her appeal was denied and her sentence remained unchanged. She would serve 25 years in prison and become eligible for parole in 12 and a half years. In the same year Siobhan was murdered, Christine Muhugana of UNICEF made the following statement: "At least three children are murdered, another three survive attempted murder, and 21 suffer grievous bodily harm. That is the average daily impact of violence against children in South Africa. Children are under attack. Families, friends, and communities are left devastated. We cannot look away. We must all come together to tackle this horrific violence that affects the futures of every child across the country. But the question remains, exactly how do we come together? When I covered the case of Poppy van der Merwe, I underpinned the importance of speaking out if you witness child abuse. And in that case, someone had reported the abuse, but not enough was done to save the child. And in this case, just in the month before Siobhan died, two people tried to get authorities to intervene. So exactly what do we need to do to make a real impact when we become aware of child abuse? The truth seems to be that not very many people know. Remember how two people in this case reported the abuse to Childline, and both were referred to the police. I want to point out that Childline actually did exactly what they are mandated to do by virtue of their role as an organisation. No child can be removed from their home for any length of time without a court order to do so. And to get that court order, the police need to be involved and have done at least some peripheral investigation. Childline's website details the role they play in the chain of advocacy against child abuse, and they are not involved in investigating or actioning investigations. This is the case with many other similar nonprofits and NGOs. They may provide really important services to victims, but they are not able to remove children from homes. And really, getting involved by acting as a third party between the reporter and the police is actually just a waste of time and resources and puts the organization at risk if something goes wrong. I know this sounds counterintuitive, but most of these organizations simply cannot get involved. And the best thing for everyone is for them to refer people to the SAPS. I know for a fact that it is incredibly difficult to figure out how to report child abuse. Heck, Google it and you'll get a wide range of answers. A carte blanche journalist went undercover into an SAPS office and asked how they could report abuse. And the officer sent her to SASSA. Yes, the people who deal with the administration of social grants. But in my research, I was able to find a very clear answer provided by an actual SAPS resource. If you suspect that a child is being abused, you do need to report it directly to the SAPS. Not any other activism organization or anywhere else, go to the SAPS. At the SAPS office, you tell the officer that you wish to make a report of child abuse and you want to speak with an officer from the Family Violence, Child Protection and Sexual Offences Unit, also called the FCS Unit. This is the unit that is going to investigate the case anyway, and it's the most direct route to getting help. Each police station falls within a designated cluster, and an FCS unit is assigned to serve all stations within that cluster. If you are told that the case falls outside of their jurisdiction, that is not a reason for them not to take your report. The FCS officer must take the report, even if they end up handing it over to a unit in a different jurisdiction. The resource I consulted about this says the same thing I say about missing person reports. If you are refused assistance around reporting a child abuse case, you must insist on being helped. In general, our SAPS officers are hardworking individuals who are really just poorly resourced and overworked. But as in any occupation, There are bad apples who will do what they can to not have to do their jobs. If you are refused assistance, insist on speaking with the station commander or the head of detectives. Once you've been assisted, take the case or occurrence number down and get the contact details for the officer you've spoken with so you can follow up. And now, of course, this procedure is only going to work if you don't want to necessarily be anonymous. Reporting child abuse is often more complex from a personal perspective than other crimes. And often, while you do want the child in question to be helped, you don't necessarily want the parents to know you reported them. In this situation, you can ask that the officers don't mention your name, but there is absolutely no guarantee that others won't discover you were involved. And if the case were to ever go to court, you may also be called to testify. So these are the things you need to weigh up. If you do wish to remain anonymous, there are options open to you, which include the Crime Stoppers number, 08600 10111, or the SAPS's app. These options, unfortunately, are not going to guarantee any urgency, and you may never know whether your anonymous tip has been followed up. It's also important to remember that what we think should happen in cases of child abuse is not always what actually does happen. South Africa, like many other countries, is primarily focused on retaining the family unit. And where possible, authorities will always try to ensure the child either stays with the family under supervision or is returned to them once issues related to alleged abuse have been resolved, if possible. This, of course, applies if no charges are filed and the parents or parents are not incarcerated. There is a very thin line to walk between assuring the safety of a child and not traumatizing them even more in the system. And not all cases will be as severe as Siobhan and her siblings. But if you're seeing injuries, bruising, and other clear signs of abuse which may put the child's life in danger, I highly recommend you go straight to your closest SAPS office. Of course, contacting activist and assistance organizations outside of SAPS for advice and guidance is absolutely fine. But know that it is not these organizations' responsibility to report and follow through the case, and they may not do so. I also want to make a note about photographing children's injuries, especially when doing so requires them to remove their clothing. Although sometimes this might be the only way to get evidence of the abuse, you need to be really careful about photographing minors in any state of undress. You also need to be very careful about where you share those photos. In absolutely no circumstances should photos like that be shared on social media, even if the child's face is blanked out. Not only is that a violation of the child's rights to privacy, it's also technically illegal. If you are able to get the child to a hospital, your best bet is to have a doctor there record the injuries on the appropriate form and take photographs themselves. If that is not possible, and you absolutely have to take such photographs for evidentiary purposes, please just be incredibly careful with them and ensure that once police have confirmed they have them logged as evidence, you destroy the photographs completely. With all of this said, while reporting child abuse is never an easy decision to make, and a lot of people would rather not get involved in case they're wrong about what they're seeing or hearing, I personally feel that this is one of those situations where you'd rather be wrong than have a child suffer the type of abuse that Siobhan and her siblings did. I personally would much rather blow up a friendship or a family connection completely than live with the knowledge that I could have done something to help and didn't. With that said, we also can't lay the responsibility on those around the children. The people who need to account for what they're doing are the abusers themselves. So often, extreme cases of child abuse like this involve substance abuse, poverty, and a toxic relationship between caregivers. But that is not always the case either. Just recently, a couple from Bloubergstrand, a relatively high-income area in the Western Cape, have been arrested on numerous counts of child abuse and the production of child sexual abuse material involving their own two children. Their children have been removed from their care, and just a tip of the iceberg of information that has come out about what these children endured is revolting and infuriating. In Jaden Lee Meek's case, we're hearing that he may have told his teachers that he was being abused, and they, who are mandatory reporters, may not have followed through with reports to the SAPS. Scrolling through his mother's social media, she appears to be an incredibly loving single mom who, although not wealthy by any means, was working and able to provide for herself and her son. Tiffany Meek is, of course, innocent until proven guilty, and she insists she did not kill her son. But I think what this shows me is that there is no single face of child abuse. Not all children who are being abused walk around with bruises on their faces or split lips. Not all abusive caregivers have drug problems or live on the poverty line. Many appear as completely loving parents in public. Many are actively hiding the abuse of their children, and only those closest to them might ever figure it out. And that person might be you. From a legal perspective, I would really like to see mothers in cases like this receiving equal sentences to the other individual involved in the abuse. Jocelyn Smith's mother recently received a life sentence for human trafficking of her daughter, which was heartening to see. But that was a different charge, and most abusers won't be charged with trafficking. In a case where rape and murder were aided and abetted, though, I see absolutely no reason why a mother should not also be handed down a life sentence, unless there is solid proof that she was essentially a prisoner in her own home with no way to contact the outside world. Every time I cover a case like this, I say, perhaps telling this story will help to prevent this from happening again. And yet, it always does happen again. But I do know for sure that information provided in other episodes about the right way to report crimes and the signs to look for have helped to prevent further abuse and other crimes because people have reached out to me to tell me so. And if that is the only small positive thing that can come from the horrific death Siobhan suffered, that's, I guess, is something at least. I can't really imagine how much of a sociopath you have to be to enjoy inflicting pain on a helpless 2-year-old child. It just does not compute in my brain. And for that, I'm thankful. My greatest concern is that as these cases of abuse seem to become more and more common, and more are ending in the death of a child and the significant psychological scarring of their siblings, we're seeing a generation of children produced who live with all those challenges Luke Lumprecht mentioned. And that doesn't mean they're going to become abusers themselves, but it does mean that they will carry that in other ways for the rest of their lives. They are desensitized to violence. They have learned to trust no one. And they have accepted that their abusers did not see them as human beings. They will move through their adult lives with all of this trauma if they are not able to get help. And the results of that in future will be devastating for everyone. Child abuse is not just prevalent now. And I know that many of you listening will have experienced some form of abuse as children. We can't change that now. But I move through the world trying to be the type of adult that I needed as a child. And maybe you can too. Siobhan Avril Rush was born into chaos. She was born to a very young mother, who, in my opinion, absolutely should not have had three young children at the age of 23. Yes, I know, that used to be the norm back in the day. But let's be honest, didn't work out too well then either. 40 days before she died, Siobhan's life was completely different. She was a carefree toddler, dancing to her favorite song, with a full tummy, an injury-free body, and the knowledge that she was loved. Then, for just over a month, she lived in hell, in fear, in pain, and probably wondering what she'd done to deserve it all. Siobhan is every child. She is the picture of innocence. And her 49 injuries and painful, terrifying death is an indictment on the two people who killed her, but also on a society that continues to look away, to preserve our own comfort. It's not my problem. I'm not getting involved. What if I'm wrong? What if you're right? The last image I hold on to when I think of Siobhan is of her 4 days before her death in the home of a woman who was still trying to save her when she took her last breath. Clean, fed, warm, safe. Such simple things that we all take for granted. At least in that moment, for a few hours, she knew she was loved. Siobhan Rush, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.